Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. Trevor Daniels, who's a partner at Coors Chambers Withgard, is going to introduce our speaker. Trevor, thank you.
Thanks, Jared. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Tanya Plibersek, Minister for Housing and Minister for Status of Women, again to our offices. Welcome back. Tanya, I remember back in June 2007 reading the paper that you put out as the then Shadow Minister, New Directions for Affordable Housing, and the number of initiatives that you had identified there: support for first home buyers, the Housing Affordability Fund, the National Rental Affordability Scheme, and the recognition of the key role of the community housing providers. And now, a year and a half later, how pleasing it is to see that these items are all being implemented, that they're on top of the COAG agenda, and that social housing is a significant component in the stimulus package, the Nation Building and Jobs Plan. So we very much look forward to hearing from you this evening on what is happening in that area. I'm also very pleased that it's such an integral element of what I see as a well-thought-through social inclusion program. So please welcome to Coors and look forward to hearing from you. Thank you.
Thank you, Trevor, and thank you, Jared and Anne, for the invitation to speak to you tonight. I want to start by acknowledging that we're meeting on the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and pay my respects to their elders. The role of public housing at its inception during Australia's post-war reconstruction was to create an affordable and secure base from which tenants could build or rebuild their lives. Public housing was a springboard, allowing people to land softly and then jump out of disadvantage. It still plays this role for some Australians, but for many tenants it's no longer the case. As a Minister for Housing, I hear from young single parents concerned about the way their kids are growing up in areas where drugs are too readily available. I hear from older women living alone who are scared to go out or who are kept up at night by noisy or violent neighbours. I hear from older people who struggle to walk up the flights of stairs in the buildings that they've lived in for 30 years. I believe that we can do much better when it comes to social housing. After more than a decade of inaction and reduced investment, housing is once again a national priority for the Australian Government. We put in place $20 billion worth of policies and measures right across the housing market, from home ownership to homelessness. Our initiatives are assisting Australians in all forms of housing tenure. Young families are being encouraged to buy their first home, and we're significantly stimulating the economy with the $1.5 billion first home owners boost. We're tackling rental affordability for low income households with the new idea of a national rental affordability scheme, which provides tax incentives to those who build new low cost rental accommodation. And we've committed to halving homelessness by 2020 with a national action plan and an additional $1.2 billion for better services and for specialist models of accommodation. To add to this, we're making the single largest investment ever in social housing ever made by an Australian government. And that's a massive opportunity for us to reform our social housing system. A system that now takes in community, not-for-profit and cooperative housing, as well as state-run public housing departments. There are many well-known Australians who credit their time in public housing for their later success. People like Brian Brown, John Alexander, and one of the few men who've gone straight from club cricket to opening the batting for Australia, Dave Warner. You know that, of course, I didn't know that little bit of cricket trivia. It just shows that we've got an office that's got a wide range of skills, that one of my staff knew that about Dave Warner. Businessman John Alexander was once a kid running around a public housing estate, and he said, the Housing Commission wasn't welfare-based that perhaps it is for people today. Going into a Housing Commission house allowed you to build up some capital to buy your own house, which is what my parents subsequently did. Suburbs like Elizabeth in South Australia or Broadmeadows in Victoria were built to house workers in the Ford or Holden car plants. Inner city developments were created to house families that had been living in substandard housing that was making them sick. Suburbs here in Sydney like Warwick Farm or Jenali, where I went to school, housed many returned servicemen and their families. Living in that stable environment allowed people to take up work opportunities, to build assets and to set their families on a path to self-sufficiency. Take Cathy Rogers, who in 1956 became the first woman in New South Wales to buy her Housing Commission home. She had three children and her husband was dying. They moved into a Housing Commission home in Liverpool in 1947, and 2 weeks before her husband's death, she bought her home and spent the next 32 years cleaning houses to pay it off. For many people, like Cathy, public housing is a very successful story. But today's public housing caters for a very different group of tenants. Reduced government investment has meant much tighter targeting, and that in turn has resulted in the profile of public housing tenants becoming more disadvantaged over the years. We have more jobless households in public housing. 66% of working age adult households were jobless in 2001 compared to 43% in 1981. We've got a higher percentage of sole parents in public housing, but the biggest increase has been the number of public housing tenants who are receiving the disability support pension. Around 1 in 12 households were receiving the DSP in 1981, where now 1 in 4 receive the disability support pension. Supporting public housing tenants today requires more than just a house, more than just a roof over their head. And while the needs of people in public housing has changed, the system hasn't. Over the 10 years to 2007, the Commonwealth's contribution to the states for public housing fell by 24%. That led to a $3.1 billion decline in investment by 2008. The impact of no growth in public housing is that stock has not kept up with demand. When Labor was last in government, public housing was 5.8% of total housing stock, and if that proportion had been retained, we'd have another 90,000 extra units of public housing today. Instead, our average public housing stock is between 20 and 29 years old. 14% of the stock is more than 50 years old. Any of you who live in an old house like I do know how expensive it is to care for old houses. The cost of maintaining a 30-year-old dwelling is twice that for a dwelling 15 years old. A large number of public housing properties across the country are three-bedroom detached homes, and of course those homes don't suit the largest populations of public housing tenants, who are older single people or young families with lots of kids. We have other problems that arise because too much of our public housing stock is concentrated in particular areas. While public housing makes up around 4% of Australia's housing stock, just over 4%. In some local government areas, a third or more of housing is public housing. Flemington in Melbourne and the Adelaide suburb of Manopara have heavy concentrations of public housing, with around 28% of homes in these suburbs being public housing. Windale in Newcastle has about two-thirds of its homes as public housing. Often this housing was built to support local industries, like the car industries that I mentioned, but in many cases those industries have changed and left those local areas. So while some estates have strong feelings of community, many others have little mutual support, trust and cooperation between tenants. Children grow up in jobless households and jobless neighbourhoods and see very few employed adults as role models. There are fewer people around who have the means to lend a hand or offer a hand up. And people on these estates are likely to be dislocated from jobs, services and transport. they can become entrenched in their social isolation, with young people having an expectation that they'll grow up to rely on public housing just as their parents have. And in fact, I've even heard of parents discouraging their kids, their teenagers, from getting jobs because if the household income rises, the household rent increases. These neighbourhoods are regularly featured in reports on the most disadvantaged postcodes by researchers such as Tony Vinson. The way that we provide social housing has not kept pace with these significant socio-demographic changes. Social housing around the country is still primarily run by housing departments that we established after the Second World War to build and manage this housing. There's usually one large provider in each state that plans, owns, develops and manages most of the housing, social housing stock in that state. All systems, all states have modernised their systems, and there are very good examples of where public housing departments are making better links with homelessness organisations or other human services organisations, where they're doing spot purchasing of housing in more diverse locations and taking better approaches to maintenance. But we still are left with a problem that we're not delivering opportunities for public housing tenants. 90% of social housing stock in this country is held by 8 government providers, and our systems are not transparent or accountable enough. I'm determined to use the $6.4 billion component of the Nation Building and Jobs Plan to transform social housing in this country. The Australian Government's reform agenda is ambitious and long-term. COAG has agreed to a reform agenda, and at the end of next week I'll be meeting with state and territory housing ministers to agree on how the reforms that we've all signed on to will be implemented. Success for me will mean that social housing tenants and their children will have better outcomes in life, that social housing providers will be innovative, responsive and creative, and that our housing system will be efficient and nimble. I want some future housing minister to hear from young families with kids who spent a few years in public housing when times were tough, and then when they were able to get more hours of work, perhaps bought a part share in a house through a shared equity scheme and eventually moved into home ownership. I want that future housing minister to hear from older couples in public housing who live right next door to, in the same building, as young couples who are paying off their first home. Or from a young person who's got a mental illness, but whose illness has stabilised because they're living in stable accommodation close to family who can offer support. The centrepiece of our reform agenda is to facilitate the growth of a number of sophisticated not-for-profit housing associations that'll operate alongside existing state-run housing authorities. In 2007, community housing organisations held 34,700 properties nationally, compared with about 340,000 properties owned by state-run housing departments. For the most part, community housing organisations are relatively small, in some cases very small, with as few as 10 properties to manage. There are about 1,000 providers nationally, some, as I say, very small, but a few of them owning as many as 1,000 properties. Overall, they are generally very good at tenancy management. They often have lower rates of rental arrears than state housing departments and a better track record of maintenance. Among the ranks of community housing providers, there are 11 organisations known as growth providers. These organisations are growing along a commercial path, often with the backing of governments and financial institutions. Growth providers like Community Housing Limited or Common Equity in Victoria or the Brisbane Housing Company are now property developers in their own right. They're partnering with large developers and major banks to take on big developments like Kensington in Victoria or Bonnyrigg here in New South Wales. They're developing sizeable balance sheets, some in excess of $300 million, and they're leveraging usually an extra 25% from the private sector on top of their government subsidies. They buy blocks of inner city land to create mixed communities. Their tenants live in developments alongside young families who are buying their first home, or retirees who have downsized, or young singles renting an inner city flat. Often these growth providers are able to work more flexibly than state-run housing authorities. In many cases, they're able to provide a range of housing products, like subsidised rental homes for key workers, rent-to-buy programs or shared equity schemes. It's my very strong view that these growth providers offer a means to deliver an innovative, flexible and the innovation, the flexibility and the commerciality we need to transform our social housing system. Over the next 5 years, I'd like to see more large, commercially sophisticated not-for-profit housing associations emerge and operate alongside the existing state and territory housing departments. I'd like to see organisations operating in different markets, including across state borders, providing a range of housing products for low and moderate income Australians to offer the opportunity of a housing career to low income Australians. This would include products like affordable rental homes under our National Rental Affordability Scheme or shared equity as a start to home ownership. I expect these organisations will set standards in different areas, be it in the cost of construction, the cost of maintenance, the social mobility of their tenants, or partnerships with private finance and builders. The Australian Government will invest over $7 billion in coming years in affordable rental and social housing. This historic investment will build 50,000 units through our National Rental Affordability Scheme and another 20,000 units through the social housing part of our Nation Building and Jobs Plan. 70,000 new homes. These significant funding streams will develop the social housing system we need for the future. And that system has to include new providers at scale to bring contestability for the first time to social housing in this country. The Australian Government's proposing that a significant proportion of the new stock being constructed through our Nation Building and Jobs Plan will be transferred to the community housing sector by 2014. I'm also starting work right now on the new regulatory environment that we'll need, with timeframes for national regulation and registration to be announced later this year. COAG's agreed to establish independent prudential supervision for social housing providers. That's very important because we're talking about substantial investments of public funds. At the moment, we simply don't know how much of the social housing dollar is spent on capital, on construction, how much is spent on rent subsidies, and how much is spent on tenancy support. It's simply unacceptable. We need reliable and comparable information on the relative costs of construction, of maintenance, whether that's for government or for community housing providers. I intend to improve the transparency and accountability of social housing across the board. Within 2 or 3 years, we'll be clearly able to benchmark the costs and performance of different providers. I've also restarted the discussion about the way that Commonwealth funds are allocated. For decades, the Commonwealth has provided social housing funding to the states and territories on a population share basis. The level of the Commonwealth subsidy per social housing dwelling has varied enormously from $1,375,000 per unit per annum in South Australia to $3,175,000 per unit per annum in Queensland in 2006-07. It's perverse that in the face of high demand for social housing, our funding system actually provides no incentive for states to increase their stock. In fact, it does the opposite. The funding provided by the Commonwealth to the states is not linked in any way to the number of public housing dwellings that they're providing or the number of renting households that they're assisting. So the more public housing a state has, the thinner the Commonwealth subsidy is spread. I'd like to see the Commonwealth providing funding to the states based on the number of dwellings in each jurisdiction to create a clear incentive for the states to retain and to build more social housing. The government's very clear that we need more affordable rental homes, including public and community housing, and that's why we've made this very significant investment. We need to create more mixed communities where public housing dwellings are a part but not a feature of the neighbourhood. mixed communities are much more likely to build social capital. The goodwill, shared values, networks, trust and reciprocity that exists in neighbourhoods. According to Professor Michael Woolcock, communities with strong social capital are in a much stronger position to confront poverty and vulnerability, resolve disputes and take advantage of new opportunities. As Professor Woolcock states, people who are well connected, I'm quoting him, are more likely to be housed, healthy, hired and happy. In the long run, I want to see state and territory governments redevelop the remaining broadacre public housing estates. They should be renewed to create mixed communities. That's the way of the future. And I'll be asking the states and territories to come back to me with their plans. This is a very long-term proposition. I expect it will take at least 10 years to achieve this renewal, because renewal has to be achieved with the support and the involvement of existing tenants. I also want to see a much better match between the homes that are on offer and the size of the households that need them, particularly for the aged. There are lots of models for providing quality accommodation for older social housing tenants. Some states have built dedicated seniors' villages, giving older people in the community the support and networks that they're looking for, and freeing up their older family homes for larger families. The Benevolent Society in Sydney's eastern suburbs is developing apartments for life based on the Dutch model that'll include social housing, private rental and units for purchase, all in the one development. I believe that there's a need for additional specialist models of accommodation, like Wintringham in Victoria, that meet the needs of particular groups, such as people who've been homeless for the long term. South Australia is currently building a new development for young adults who've been homeless that will provide education and training on site. The aim is to link housing with skills training so that these young people start on a path to independence. Developing these specialist accommodation models is one of the most important strategies to come out of our white paper on homelessness. We also need to consider the fact that our older public housing stock is less energy and water efficient, and in many cases has very poor sound insulation. We have an opportunity now with this new investment to build more energy efficient homes that respond to the issues of climate change and keep utilities costs for their tenants lower. There's a serious concern for tenants who can least afford high heat and cooling bills and who spend much of their time at home. Sound insulation for people who are at home lots of hours a day is very important. Six-star energy efficiency will become the new minimum standard for residential construction. I've already included greater energy efficiency in the guidelines for new social housing to be built under the stimulus package. Projects that create mixed communities that are well located, that deliver high standards of energy and efficiency, that are suitable for people with disabilities and for older Australians will get preference when we allocate our funds under the Nation Building and Jobs Plan this year. But reforming this area is not just about bricks and mortar. If we want a system that's a springboard to greater opportunity and economic independence, public housing tenants ought to have greater choice and control over the homes that they live in. Surely we should be able to provide people with a short list of available properties that they are eligible to rent and let them choose from that list. Choice is important. In future, I want tenants not only to be able to choose the type of property and the community that they live in, but to have a choice of providers when they're looking for social housing. I want that to be possible without tenants having to join multiple queues, so I'm asking the states and territories to establish single gateways for people to access public and community housing. Whereas public housing was once an enabler, part of a housing career which allowed working class people opportunities including home ownership, today it's too often a safety net that fails to provide the range of assistance that's required by tenants. Social housing providers cannot deliver the services that GPs should be providing, or community nurses or psychiatrists, and they shouldn't be expected to step in when other areas of government have failed. But they should be able to support improved access of tenants to health, employment and education services. Social housing providers have to work with other services, particularly for tenants who've been homeless or who live with a chronic mental illness or who are leaving violent relationships, who are ageing or who are bringing up their kids in difficult circumstances. There are terrific examples of where this is already happening, including here in New South Wales, where the government's established a program called Housing and Accommodation Support Initiative. It's known as HASI, for social housing tenants with a mental illness. It's achieving terrific outcomes. 70% of tenants are staying in the same home for 12 months or longer, and 43% of tenants have started working or studying, talking about the most disadvantaged group of social housing tenants with previously phenomenally poor outcomes. Many of them have been living on the streets. This kind of flexibility and partnership ought to be standard business for social housing providers. In the context of homelessness, states and territories have agreed to give public and private tenants better tenancy support so that they keep their homes and get access to the health and community services they need. But that's a two-way street. In return for better services, for more choice and more control of their environment, and for more opportunity, comes a responsibility for tenants towards one another and towards their property. Tenants would be expected and assisted to make the most of the support that's on offer, and to that end, tenants should be held accountable if they vandalise homes or make their neighbours' lives a misery. Tenants benefit from the security of living in public housing, and they should treat that public housing with respect. There are some tenants who are especially vulnerable and will always need social housing that's safe and suitable for them to stay well. For others, social housing will be a transition, a place from which to build or rebuild their lives. Sophisticated providers of housing need to work well with all tenants and put in place differentiated services and support targeted to their needs. The Australian Government's investment in social housing and in homelessness gives us a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to establish a flexible, responsive, transparent and enabling system of social housing, a permanent refuge for those down on their luck and a springboard for those who need a temporary hand-up. I'm determined to build a system that assists those most vulnerable but doesn't trap them into disadvantage. A social housing system that benefits our whole community.
Thanks. Do you want a glass of water?
Yeah,
I do. All right. Many thanks, Minister, and thanks to CAWS for the use of this fine facility this evening. There's a couple of seats up here if people want them. So we have till we've got about 20 minutes or so for some questions. Can I just start off by talking about the equality of all this? Many years ago, my father worked for the Housing Commission in Victoria and was a public servant. And he did tell me one story once about one chap who brought a horse indoors. But that was the exception. I mean, by and large, in those days, people in Housing Commission houses looked after their houses. They didn't trash them. But I think these days there's a degree of resentment developing because a person on a certain low income can drive past a house, renting their own house, and drive past a house of someone on the same income who's not looking after their house. I mean, I know these are matters for the state government, but what are you trying to do there to overcome this feeling of resentment that some people on low incomes don't get the kind of advantage that other people on low incomes get, in spite of the fact they might actually be more deserving in terms of how they live their lives?
Well, I think the first thing to say, it's always very important to remember that we've got, as I said, 340,000 units of public housing around the country, and another almost 40,000 on top of that that's community housing, and the vast, vast majority of people in public housing look after it well, care for it very carefully, are grateful and responsible. They know that their public housing is a precious community asset and they regard it as their home, and they look after it and care for it very well. There are a few people who don't behave well, and it is a matter for the states to have strong tenancy management practices that work with those tenants to improve their behaviour, to make sure that they are looking after their property and behaving respectfully and responsibly with their neighbours. And as a last result, as a last resort, of course, they have the option of evicting people, although that's something that should be a last resort. What we're doing, but you ask, you know, about families that are in very similar circumstances. There are, I guess, a few things to say about that. For the most part, people who've been moving into public housing in the last 10 years really are in very desperate circumstances. They're not just poor, as they were when your dad was managing public housing, and when I was growing up, low-income working people were commonly in public housing. Today, because of the much tighter rationing, it is very difficult to get into public housing unless you have a number of problems in your life. It's not just being poor. More than likely, it's poor and sick, poor and on a disability support pension. We are talking about some of the neediest people in the community. For low-income people that are not eligible for public housing, we've made a massive investment in the National Rental Affordability Scheme, which will see, in the first instance, 50,000 new affordable rental properties built over the next 4 years, and if there's still demand, another 50,000 beyond that. Of course, we continue to pay Commonwealth rent assistance and give other supports to those people. But the most important thing to do, I think, to retain community trust that public housing is going to people who need it and will care for it, is to have that strong tenancy management culture that works closely with tenants to make sure that they're looking after their properties and caring for them, and not falling behind on rent and so on. You know, Jared, when I was talking to some public housing tenants, some older ladies in my own area, Balmain, I've got a lot of public housing, and these older women said to me, you know, when we first moved into public housing, they came around 6 weeks after we moved in, they made sure we had the curtains up, and they called around every 6 months or a year to check that we were looking after the property. And I said, oh, that must have been terrible. How intrusive. You must have hated that. And all of these women said, no, we loved it because we looked after our property, and we wanted to be confident that our neighbours were looking after their property, and it made us feel that we were all part of a community that was caring for this place that we had in common. Now, a lot of community housing providers will go at least once a year to check on the apartment. They don't go in a conflictual way or a harsh way. They go in and say, I've got to check the washers, how's the carpet wearing, I see that you need, you know, the light fitting needs replacing here. But it's also an opportunity to make sure that people are caring, keeping up the care on the place that they're looking at. I think that sort of more intensive tenancy management practice is a good aspect of how the relationship that can develop if you've got these smaller, more intensive management practices.
Thanks. So, look, there's heaps of questions. We'll go down here. Let's be brief. Yeah. I hope you're not after housing. Too many here. Okay, you're right. Yeah.
Thanks for an excellent talk. And thank you for not swearing.
Okay. Well, we're not done yet.
Could you just, in your forward modelling, could you help me get a quick fix on the very biggest numbers involved, total number of people affected in or affected by public housing compared to, so on the other side of that, the total amount of public investment in terms of public housing?
Okay. I'll give you a few numbers. Public housing today is less than 5% of all housing stock. There are, as I said, 340,000 units of public housing about 40,000 units of community housing. You could calculate 1 to 2 people on average living in those. So you're talking about, you know, maybe 2/3 of a million people living in public housing. The amount of money that is tied up in public housing, the estimate is there's about $60 billion worth of public housing existing in the country now. The figures on community housing are not as clear as that, but a substantial investment. There are some larger community housing providers, as I say, that have balance sheets as large as $300 million. So there are a few quite substantial players. There are a lot of very small players, and a lot of community housing providers don't own the stock that they're managing. They manage it on behalf of the Department of Housing. We're talking about a significant number of people potentially who move through public housing in their lifetime, though. It's also not a constant population.
We've got plenty of time, so don't all have something here.
Yeah. I know this will probably be passed over as a state matter, but I'm really asking this question on behalf of a friend in Melbourne. There are many people in the community who have slightly disabled children. Like they might be autistic, they might be schizophrenic, but they're being cared for by families who are under enormous pressure. And there seems to be a problem with public housing for this particular disadvantaged group, who may have the support of families but really need some independence. How can the Commonwealth government ensure that the states allot some of this money to the needs of those kind of people?
It's a very good question. The states will always allocate housing to the people that need it most, and they'll always be making judgments about who those people are. Obviously, people with a disability should be in that category, but you're making judgments every day between someone who's got a disability and someone who's leaving an extremely violent relationship. I mean, the judgment calls about who gets public housing are very difficult ones to make. The thing that we need to do to make it easier for people in all of these groups to get a safe roof over their head is the increase the stock of available public housing. That's why we're building more of it. But we're also making it possible for newer, more innovative models of housing to exist. Now, this probably wouldn't apply to your friend, but a lot of parents of adult children with a disability have children who are quite independent. They have social activities or limited engagement with the workforce, but they're not fully independent. There's a terrific model called Abbeyfield that operates here and there in Australia, particularly in Canberra, where you've got each person has a large room of their own and a small bathroom. There's a common area with a sort of house matron that is there kind of on call. She cooks an evening meal and does the shopping and a little bit of cleaning of the common area. Our funding systems have made it really hard for models like that to exist. Now, that model is not for every adult, young adult with a disability. There are plenty of young adults with disability who want to live completely on their own. Good luck to them. But we've not offered these choices in the past, and I want a system that offers these choices and allows parents to invest some of their own money if they want to. Another measure that we've taken, there's a $100 million disability accommodation investment fund. We're also looking for ways that parents who want to invest on behalf of their children can do that more easily. It's about greater choice so that your friend's kid doesn't have to wait 10 years on the public housing list but has some different accommodation options available to them.
There's a question down the back there. Yes.
Minister, thank you for your support tonight. I've been waiting out 30 years for an outcome.
Now, we don't have a lot of time, so
make that speech.
Okay.
I'm worried about, I'm in all favour of supporting community housing organisations. I'm worried about the existing public housing organisations that are many good dedicated staff. I've had workshops with them. They've actually been very attracted to the idea of becoming a community housing organisation and decentralising those centralised organisations and looking more like a community housing organisation, if not actually becoming state businesses and start thinking about their organisation.
I think that a lot of states may head down that path anyway. I think a lot of them see an advantage in having a more nimble system with different providers in each state. And certainly I think that there are fantastic staff that work in departments of housing right around the country. And I don't necessarily see it as a bad thing to have community housing providers working side by side with Department of Housing, learning from each other. I think that having a strong community housing sector that's innovating, that's building on different models, that's using different tenancy management practices, influences the Department of Housing to become more flexible in its own approach. But equally, some of the strong public reporting obligations that departments of housing have can influence community housing providers. I think that there's room in the system for both. For both.
Yeah,
we've
got
to
be
quick.
Okay.
I've got one.
Okay, that's fine. Well, you have your hand up.
I really am very concerned about the being allowed to have pets, because for a lot of elderly people, the only person who loves them at all is their cat or dog, and for a number of disabled people, a cat or dog is, or some other pet is tremendously important, and yet very often that fails them from getting a public house.
Look, I completely agree, and I think actually most states now have much more flexible approaches to people bringing their pets into public housing. The most important thing, obviously, is some respect for your neighbours as well. So if you've got a dog or cat, you have to clean up after your dog or cat. And you can't, you know, maybe one or two dogs or cats, not 30, as some people like to have. But you're very right. I mean, we know that there are very strong social and emotional advantages in having a companion animal.
This question here, we'll go down the back here. Yeah.
Thank you very much. My name is Nava Ramirez. I came from African Women Advocacy Unit. And we have got a lot of problems about the Department of Housing. According to the flexible staff, the good staff that come to here now, my question is, when you are eligible, how long will it take? Because we have the last time they put on the key, 10 years. You are eligible, but 5 years, 10 years, until today, didn't go to that house. Now, my question, how long?
The question for those who couldn't hear up the back was how long until you become eligible for public housing? And the sad fact is that that can vary hugely right around the country. You can, in the best case scenario, it sounds a terrible thing to say, because the best case scenario means your need is extreme. But if your need is extreme, you might wait 6 weeks to 6 months, depending which state you're in. It's not at all uncommon to wait 2 years. There are people who have been on public housing waiting lists for 10 years. The waiting times vary enormously.
Shannon,
I'll
call you. Yeah.
Just earlier in your speech, you mentioned about access and rental housing. Is there any program or thought of requiring that the ownership...
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the beginning of your question, so I...
Is there any provision?
Yep.
Tax incentives for rental housing?
Yep.
And investors, under the accounting laws, are required to write off the cost of the investment?
Yep.
So it's a cost anyway. So the question is there any program where, as they write off the cost, they write off the ownership?
Oh, I see. Yep.
The tenant?
Yep.
Not only for rental housing, but any other commercial housing and the commercial investments in the area.
Well, no, there's no such program, but as part of our National Rental Affordability Scheme, we're working with many organisations whose intention it is for tenants to become eligible to buy that house that they're living in over time. And, the National Rental Affordability Scheme doesn't give a deduction, it gives a tax credit or a grant, depending on the organisation. But the point that you're making about people moving from being renters, where there's a public subsidy in their rental, to becoming homeowners is a very valid one, and it's certainly those housing careers that we want to see for many more families. Now, it's not for everyone. If you're an aged pensioner, you don't want to be taking on a mortgage when you're turning 70. But if you're a young family and your circumstances are improving over time, those pathways through rental, through shared equity, through rent-to-buy schemes, there are a number of innovative programs and ways of doing it. They could be a very good thing for many more families than currently benefit.
Do you
want to
talk about the housing element of these seminars? And how that relates to your very welcome agenda about the community housing sector. I think by virtue of the stimulus package being allocated to state governments to bid for, you may be missing some opportunities, which I know there's a great deal of pressure pressure to get done. But if some elements of it were earmarked for development by your growth providers over the next 2 years, you do two things. One is you would give a scale of activity which would support the current growth providers and more coming into the system. And secondly, you get the leverage that you talked about, 25% on top of the 6.4 million which you're putting in. So I wondered if you were trying to get that.
We're not quarantining a proportion, but we are certainly encouraging the states and territories to work with the growth providers, and we've got the final sign-off on the largest element of the package, the $5.3 billion that's for totally new build. That we are working with states and territories in the tendering process, but we've got the final sign-off on that.
Some people would say that the solutions to what has done and
I think that the long-term future of Australia does have more medium-sized cities. It isn't Sydney and Melbourne and Brisbane continuing to grow in the way they are. We've got a major cities unit in the Department of Infrastructure. We're working closely with them about the existing major cities, but also long-term planning for the country.
Well,
not in every case, but yeah.
Obviously, not in every case.
Yep.
Habitat for Humanity around the world has an ownership program, which is straight into ownership, and they even take on many of the groups of people we've talked about tonight. You know, people who just come into the country as refugees, and disabled, etc. But they don't seem to fit into any funding. Has any consideration been given to that sort of model?
Certainly, I've had a lot to do with Habitat for Humanity, and they're a terrific organisation. They haven't fitted into any funding models because there hasn't been any funding for growth for the longest time. So they haven't. I mean, they haven't benefited from funding, but neither has anyone else really. Models that have, like Habitat for Humanity, for people who don't know, where people contribute to the labour of building their own home and then, you know, end up eventually owning it, are certainly things that we're open to, but they're not on the scale that we need right now through this economic stimulus package. Like, we need to get 20,000 homes onto the ground very quickly.
It could be. It's actually on the track. There's actually a very large network.
Good
question there. Based on the present global economic situation, quite a few white-collar professional people probably lose their home and jobs. The worst situation seems to be in the US, where in some cities you already have people or families living in cars, and they actually, in some big cities, small tent cities arose already. Now, do you think that the Australian system, the social housing system, will be overwhelmed eventually because of the present situation?
Thank you for that question. People are very interested in whether the Australian housing system will be affected in the same way as overseas, and I'm convinced that it won't, that we won't suffer these same consequences for a number of reasons. The first reason is that, in fact, defaults in Australia have decreased because interest rates have gone down. So people who are managing on very high interest rates actually have a bit more fat. We've got, I have to double check the figures, but I think about 25% of Australian households are more than a year ahead in their loan repayments. So most families have some buffer. Some have a very significant buffer. That's the second reason. The third reason is we don't have nearly the rate of bad loans that the US had. The loan environment here is vastly different. So in the United States, people were intentionally lending money to families they knew couldn't repay, on the assumption that when they sold them up, when they repossessed the home would have increased in value, so the bank didn't lose anyway. But that was their business model. We haven't had that. The fourth thing is we don't have no recourse lending as they do in many US states. So people were taking on loans thinking, oh, well, I'll live here for a year and even if they kick me out, it doesn't matter, because when you walk away from your house in many US states, you walk away from the debt as well. You're not left owing as you are in Australia. If you're in negative equity, you still, you know, you lose your house and you still owe the bank money. But the fifth and most important reason that we won't have the same housing shocks that we've seen overseas is because we don't build enough houses. Mm. We are short every single year in Australia. We have been for years. The demand here is much stronger than the rate of production we've had in many years, and that's simply not the case in the US and in many parts of Europe, including Spain, UK, parts of the UK and so on.
So I hope you can clear up a contradiction that seems to be existing. One, you talk about a mix of tenancies, and you also talk about the likelihood that states will allocate to the neediest people. Now, I'm not sure whether you're talking about a mix. That's the first. The second point is, how will this overall investment that you're making in this mix, considering that it's to be a mix, what effect will that have on the current neediest waiting list?
Yeah, I mean a mix of tenure types. So you could have, say you're developing a suburb with 100 homes in it. You might set 10% of those aside for straight up and down social housing run by the Department of Housing or a community housing provider. You might set another 10% aside for something like our National Rental Affordability Scheme that provides rental properties for key workers or people further up the income scale from social housing tenants. You might have another quarter that are targeted at first home buyers, so more modest properties on smaller blocks of land. You might have the rest of that development sold, you know, in the same way as the standard market would operate. When I talk about a mixed communities, I mean a mixture of tenure types and a social mix. So not communities where, you know, a quarter or a half of people are relying on the disability support pension, for example.
We're getting right close to the end now. We've got to be very quick. There's a question down there.
Yeah.
A question about single women without children.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't hear very well. Did you say no children or a large number of children?
Single women with a large number of children.
Yes. In fact, you've picked up one of the issues. Because so much of our public housing is old. It was built at a time when the standard sort of house was built with two bedrooms, possibly three bedrooms, and they're no good for the older singles that are living there, and they're also no good for the larger families that need public housing today. So when we're building the new housing as part of the $6.4 billion economic stimulus strategy, the Nation Building and Jobs Plan, one of the things that I want to see is a much broader range of housing types. And when we redevelop over a long period of time, the big broadacre public housing estates where every house looks the same, one of the mistakes that we should never repeat is these cookie cutter houses that all look the same, because they don't meet the diverse needs of the community that needs that public housing now.
The second last question. Yeah,
thanks, Ben. You've really answered my question. I work for a peak agency, which works 20,000 families, 35,000 children. Housing is a big issue for our members, and on low income.
Thank you.
Minister,
I guess the first thing I want to say is congratulations and bring you back, I guess, to the main thing of what you're saying. There's a radical shift in the way that we think about delivering housing, affordable housing for Bodmin, and the 32 housing associations and my members across New South Wales are bursting to be part of that new agenda. So thank you and congratulations on a great vision. I just want to put one point to you. If that's going to happen, then we're going to see the not-for-profit sector, the social enterprises that will need to do that. Not just fitting into, if you like, the old mould of public housing or the old mould of charities. They're going to be doing business across the bottom half of the private rental market in all sorts of ways. Do you think that we can see some changes in the sort of the way that we think about charity law, tax law, so that they're able to do that?
We're looking at that broad issue as a government already. And the Treasurer and I have had a number of discussions about how we'll proceed in that area.
Final question. Knowing a lot of these issues are with the states, if you came back here in a year's time, what do you think you'd be able to report? I mean, how many of the 20,000 do you think would be built? I mean, what's a realistic hope in the next 12 months?
We're going to build 75% of these 20,000 homes by the end of 2010. That is a massive undertaking. I know that. It's difficult. But we have to do it. We have to do it because people have been waiting too long for a roof over their heads. But we also have to do it because one of the most important drivers of this investment are the jobs that this will create at a time when Australia is extraordinarily vulnerable to the international downturn that most other countries are experiencing. About 9% of workers are employed in construction or related fields. It's almost 1 million workers in Australia. The employment aspects of this building program are also very important to me. So we're going to build them, Jared. We're already doing the repairs and maintenance.
Take a seat. I'll be very brief. We've had an important talk, plus over 30 minutes of questions and discussion. So it's been a busy night. So the Minister was here not so long ago talking in a capacity as Minister for the Status of Women, and tonight talking in a capacity as Minister for Housing. And you've had some important pronouncements tonight. And no doubt we'll see you back in the future. But for tonight, thanks and well done. And keep up the good work. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.